Today is Wednesday, September 19th, 2018, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Bertel for Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, a deal has been reached at the Korean summit. We'll go to Seoul for details.
It's just been chaos over the past few days, and I wanted to help for those who have lost so much.
We'll meet some of the volunteers helping the victims of Hurricane Florence recover. And we'll meet the man that keeps an orchestra on key. It's all on today's International Edition. The summit between North and South Korea continued Wednesday, with some significant progress being made. VOA Steve Miller is covering the meetings from Seoul. Steve, what are the key details?
Well, you have to remember that Moon went to North Korea with three main objectives. First, improving inter-Korean relations. Two, acting as a mediator between North Korea and the United States to help facilitate denuclearization talks. And three, to de-escalate military tensions between the two Koreas. So today's declaration actually focused on all three. With regards to inter-Korean relations, the Pyongyang Declaration actually outlined a number of objectives, resuming the Kaesong Industrial Complex operation, resumption of the Mount Kumgang resort tours, rebuilding and connecting roads and railways on the east and west coast, as well as developing tourist and economic zones. So that addressed the first part of it. With regards to denuclearization, the pair actually agreed to dismantle a key rocket test facility, the Dongcheng-ri test facility, and Kim Jong-un actually offered up to dismantle the Yongbyon nuclear test facility if the United States takes appropriate corresponding measures. And then finally, on the inter-Korean de-escalation of military ties, North and South Korea actually signed what they call a comprehensive military agreement, and that did a number of things. It created a line of communication between the two militaries to help facilitate communication so there wouldn't be any accidental clashes. They also agreed to halt military exercises within the demilitarized zone beginning in November. And they also said that they would work to reduce the number of guard posts along the DMZ.
Well, it sounds like there were a lot of things accomplished. I guess the question is about follow-through. What challenges do the two sides face moving forward?
Well, the primary challenges right now are with the economic development measures that were outlined in the Pyongyang Declaration. A lot of what is specifically outlined run afoul of UN and U.S. sanctions. So some analysts believe that while the document outlined a number of things, some say that this is really a carrot to try and get Kim Jong-un to move forward on denuclearization, and that when he does that, then sanctions would be lifted, and then these economic cooperative steps could be made. Plus, it still remains to be seen what will happen with regards to future discussions between the United States and North Korea.
So before anything can be implemented, the United States is going to have to get back involved in these talks.
Right, and many analysts and President Moon have said that the denuclearization issue really is between North Korea and the United States rather than between the two Koreas.
Okay, were there any surprise announcements from today's meetings?
Actually, there were a few, the first of which happened right after the signing ceremony during the joint press conference, and that was when President Moon Jae-in of South Korea announced that he had extended an offer to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to travel south to Seoul before the end of the year, and Kim Jong-un accepted that.
All right, Steve Miller in Seoul, thank you so much for your coverage of this important summit between North and South Korea.
My pleasure.
Among the top stories in the world, a high court in Pakistan has ordered the release of former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, his daughter and son-in-law, suspending the sentences handed to them for corruption. Videos of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro eating steaks at an upscale restaurant have sparked worldwide outrage on behalf of the poverty-stricken people of his country. China has held talks with the U.S. in an attempt to urge Washington not to require some Chinese state media outlets to register as foreign agents. Macedonia's constitutional court has rejected two bids to declare illegal and unconstitutional the upcoming referendum on renaming the country North Macedonia. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA reports that it has successfully launched a new satellite that is designed to accurately measure the ice of the Earth's polar regions. Called the Ice Cloud and Land Elevation Satellite 2, or ICESat-2, the new unmanned satellite recently lifted off from the Vandenberg Air Force Base atop a United Launch Alliance's final Delta II rocket. The satellite will circle the globe from pole to pole. Like its predecessor, the original ICESat, whose mission took place between 2003 and 2010, this new ice-measuring satellite has only one instrument aboard. The Advanced Topographic Laser Altimeter System, or ATLAS, will emit visible green laser pulses at a rate of 10,000 times per second. The pulses will gather the data to allow scientists to estimate the annual height change of the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets to within 4 millimeters. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
And we continue with VOA's International Edition. As hopes are raised a bloodbath can be avoided in Syria's Idlib province, the downing of a Russian aircraft with the loss of all 15 people on board underscored the dangers of confrontation on the ground and in the skies over Syria. Russia said the reconnaissance plane was downed by Syrian anti-aircraft systems as a result of the presence of Israeli warplanes. U.S. Envoy James Jeffries said the unfortunate incident is a reminder of the need to find a permanent, peaceful, and political resolution to the conflict. History professor Michael Fishbach of Randolph-Macon College in Virginia told VOA's Victor Beatty it points out the serious threat Syria poses to regional peace.
Number one is, in some ways, the skies over Syria have been a kind of semi-controlled free-for-all zone in the past two or three years. American aircraft, Russian aircraft, Syrian aircraft, Israeli aircraft, and they have been coordinating to some degree. Now, the Russians say that the Israelis have given them about a minute's notice in this recent incident, which is hardly enough time. So in some ways, the idea that there's been some sort of tragic misunderstanding is, on one level, surprising that it hasn't happened thus far. But I think what's most remarkable to me is Israel saying, well, it's actually really the Syrians' fault. It's not our fault, meaning somehow we're allowed to attack your country, and the fact that you shot down a Russian plane by mistake is really your fault. And the fact that the Russians seemingly now have switched and backed down seems even more remarkable. There's an awful lot more going on here.
That it resulted in a phone conversation between the two countries' leaders. Is this going to cause Israel to cut back on its airstrikes targeting Iranian targets in Syria?
I doubt it. There have been dozens and dozens of these in the past several years. Israel's made no bones about the fact that when it comes to men and supplies that are either Iranian or on the way to Hezbollah in Lebanon, that it reserves the right to go into, you know, sovereign Syrian territory and attack. I think what's more remarkable is how the Russians have played this. And I think on some levels, there's a fundamental changing of priorities in the Middle East as far as Turkey, Iran, Israel, Saudi Arabia. I think a lot of countries are looking, in a sense, in the next 10 years and who are going to be their enemies and what are going to be their priorities. And there have been a lot of reports that even though Russia is helping Syria, that Russia shares a concern with Israel and the United States that when the civil war in Syria is over, there could be too much Iranian influence in Syria, too many Iranian troops in Syria. Certainly Turkey has something to say about that. So I think a lot of the recent meetings and phone calls among Russia, Turkey, Israel, and by extension the United States and Saudi Arabia, all have to do with what's going to be the Middle East in the next 5 or 10 years, and particularly how is Iran going to feature into this. And I think that helps explain a lot of these seemingly strange turnabouts.
Michael Fischbach says a major confrontation appears also to have been avoided because of the close relationship the Israeli and Russian leaders have forged over Iran's presence in Syria. China's second highest-ranking official delivered a confident message Wednesday amid the looming trade war with the United States. Beijing will survive. The remarks from Premier Li Keqiang seem directed at U.S. President Donald Trump as fresh tariff announcements bring the United States and China closer to an all-out trade war. VOA's Ira Melman spoke with Alan Sykes, professor of law at the Stanford University Law School and a leading expert on international economic relations, about the situation.
Well, I don't know that there's any formal definition of full-fledged trade war, but it certainly seems like a trade war to me. It's been cycling up from relatively low-scale activity on washing machines and solar panels to steel and aluminum, and now tens of billions of dollars in all sorts of products.
What is going to happen now that China has not backed down? President Trump has threatened there is another phase where just about everything that China, anything that can be subject to a tariff will be done. Do you see this as moving in that direction? And what about the scheduled meetings for early next week?
Well, it's certainly a sort of kind of a brinksmanship situation here. The president imposed these tariffs the last day or so and announced at the same time that he would impose many more if China retaliated, and China has retaliated. So now I suppose the ball is in President Trump's court to decide whether to follow through on his threat of additional Chinese tariffs. I think that there's a strong amount of pressure on both countries to bring this to an amicable conclusion. It's not going to help either economy. China is relatively weaker than we are right now, but it will begin to take its toll on the United States, one suspects, fairly soon. So, you know, meetings next week are a good sign. Whether there will be an atmosphere where something can actually get accomplished, I don't know. I don't have any prediction for how this will turn out.
Is there any light at the end of the tunnel for such a meeting?
Well, certainly China could make some concessions on things. The president has never been terribly specific about exactly what he wants China to do, which is it's harmful in one sense because it's not clear what he would accept as a satisfactory resolution. On the other hand, it gives enormous flexibility to both sides to settle on relatively modest concessions and declare victory.
Where do you stand on tariffs?
Well, I think certainly tariffs over the long term are harmful to the world economy. They reduce productive efficiency. They reduce global income. An ideal world would be a world without tariffs. But at the same time, you know, one can make an argument that if you could negotiate a better outcome through the use of temporary tariffs to gain negotiating leverage, and if you could use tariffs to get better protection for U.S. intellectual property, for example, it's conceivable that the tariff policy might actually work out to the benefit of the United States in the long run. But that's it all depends on how the negotiation plays out. And my crystal ball is in the shop. I just don't know what's going to happen.
How much is this hurting and how much could it hurt U.S. consumers, U.S. farmers, anyone else who might be affected by these tariffs?
I can't give you quantitative figures in response to your question, but certainly as the scope of the tariffs broadens, more and more U.S. buyers of Chinese goods are going to be affected. And as the tariff rates rise from the initial 10% to 25% and so forth, the pain will increase as well. Certainly we're having this latest round involves more consumer products, more important industrial products. And China has threatened to potentially try and cut off some exports of things to the United States that are really an essential part of our supply chain. So it's possible that it could become quite painful.
That's VOA's Ira Melman speaking with Professor Alan Sykes via Skype. This is International Edition on VOA.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time, Saturdays and Sundays, on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. President Donald Trump says it's very hard for him to imagine that Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh sexually assaulted a teenage girl 36 years ago when both were in high school. The alleged attack has left the woman fearful for her life. She's asking the FBI to investigate her allegation before testifying before a Senate committee. AP's Sagar Meghani reports.
Will Christine Blasey Ford testify, and when? Her lawyers say it will only happen after the FBI investigates the allegation, something President Trump has rejected. The Senate Judiciary Committee invited Ford to testify Monday, and GOP leaders are suggesting that's her only shot. Chairman Chuck Grassley says an FBI probe will have no bearing on Ford's own testimony, so there's no reason to delay. The panel's also invited Kavanaugh to the hearing, and the president says his high court pick is anxious to appear. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
President Trump is in North Carolina today, getting a firsthand look at the devastation caused by Hurricane Florence last weekend. Flooding and polluted water continue to be major issues for the population. But even with the lack of electricity and flooded roads, neighbors are working together in small towns across the hard-hit coastline. VOA's Catherine Gibson has more from North Carolina.
The coastline may take time to recover, but here in small-town New Bern, hard work is erasing the hurricane's mark.
It came up to about here on me.
Florence swept up the street, turning Camilla Wheeler's once orderly clothing store into a muddy mess. At the height of the storm, she thought she was losing everything. The aftermath showed her the strength of community.
A bunch of people in here just are volunteers. They just felt like, we're just so touched.
Lucas Jordan didn't know Wheeler before today. He says that's just what neighbors do for each other.
It's just been chaos over the past few days, and I wanted to help for those who have lost so much.
A stranger walking off the street giving up his day, and old friends helping friends out, even as they have their own hurricane-damaged homes to worry about.
They're friends, they're of the neighborhood, of my community, and I'm just here to help.
The hurricane's path is clear right through to even smaller Oriental North Carolina. Derek Wazzle has lived in this neighborhood his whole life, surrounded by family. But his home looks very different now.
It was rough looking. Yeah, it was tore up. Trees all across the road. Light pole down.
Just down the road, family is at work changing that, helped with a little bit of luck.
The tree just missed the house by a foot and a half, so we were blessed.
An attitude of thankfulness.
It's gonna be pretty rough. We got to try to make it. The only thing we can do now is stick together.
As the Carolina coast rebuilds. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, New Bern, North Carolina.
Visit voanews.com for more on recovery efforts from Hurricane Florence. He's an unsung hero in the music world, rarely seen and always tinkering behind the scenes. His expert ear is crucial to every performance, every concerto. His name is Rodney Butler, and he is a piano tuner with the U.S. National Symphony Orchestra. Karina Bafradinjin has the story.
Rodney Butler has been tuning pianos for 30 years. For the last decade, he has worked at Washington's Kennedy Center, an unseen yet indispensable member of the U.S. National Symphony Orchestra. Growing up, Rodney dreamed of becoming a musician himself, but stage fright ended that aspiration. But Rodney couldn't abandon music altogether and decided to help his brothers, who owned a piano studio.
And then I realized how tuning of the piano affected the harmony. And of course, I was always drawn to jazz music. And so the two kind of came together in me at about the age of 16. And my brother Rick gave me a course in piano tuning. It was a great big book. And I would literally at that age sit down on the baby grand in our house and practice tuning at that age.
Rodney prefers to work alone. He says he connects with the instrument better that way. He works primarily with Steinway grand pianos, of which the Kennedy Center owns seven, each one costing as much as $100,000. Butler says they can look the same, but each piano is uniquely different, each with a different voice, much like the musicians he works with. Among them, Kirill Gerstein, an American pianist of Russian descent, who left a lasting impression on the young tuner.
And I learned so much from him. He didn't object to the piano, but he wanted it set up in a certain way. He showed me how he wanted it set up. In a matter of 20 minutes, I was able to make the adjustments to the piano. And it was amazing to me because I played a little bit for him. He knows I'm interested in music, and how awesome for him to be interested in the mechanics of the piano and be able to communicate that to me. It was just an incredible experience for me.
Butler never turned his childhood dream into reality, but he says he's happy things turned out this way.
But fortunately with piano work, I have a confidence with regard to that I lack in so many other areas of my life, which has allowed me to be very creative in my approach here at the Kennedy Center, because I'm not burdened with second guessing. I'm able to be an artist and be creative without all of the mental anguish that goes with trying to perform music in front of people.
Performers who have benefited from Butler's finely tuned ear say he's an artist in his own right, but one who does not need to hear the audience applause to know he's done his job well. Karina Bafradjin for VOA News, Washington.
And you've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com or like us on Facebook at VOA Now. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, our engineer, Suleiman Terawali, and I'm Jim Bertel for Sarah Williams in Washington. Thanks for listening.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on.